Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm introducing Bruce Gagnon again today, who is the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. He was the recipient of the Benjamin Box Peacemaker Award in 2006, and in 2010 he was extensively featured in the award-winning documentary called Pax Americana and the Weaponization of Space. Bruce was originally Republican. He was in the Air Force, but he had an awakening and is working on space issues and has been doing that for 27 years. His book called Come Together Right Now, Organizing Stories from a Fading Empire, was republished in 2008. Bruce Gagnon's articles have appeared in many publications, and he writes a popular blog called Organizing Notes. He also initiated the Maine campaign to bring our war dollars home in 2009, which spread to other New England states and beyond. This campaign made the important connection between endless war spending and fiscal crisis throughout the US. Bruce has just been on our program, and he's on again to cover a lot of important issues that we didn't have time to cover in the first interview. So welcome to the program today, Bruce Gagnon.
Thank you, Helen.
Now, I want you to go through the whole thing. I want you to describe to the audience, Bruce, please, what is full-spectrum dominance? Tell us where it was derived, originated, who's in it, and what does it mean?
Well, the U.S. Space Command, is a relatively new command in terms of the Pentagon.
How new? How new?
Well, it's been about 20 years now, but still that's relatively
yes.
new as things go.
Yeah.
They were put in charge of giving the U.S. complete control and domination of space. And so the idea of full-spectrum dominance really came out of the Space Command. And the idea is that with space technology in place, with military satellites up there, listening to everything, seeing everything on the Earth, and being able to target everything and every place on the Earth, that the U.S. would be able to control conflict at every level, so that the troops on the ground, the boats in the ocean, the ships in the ocean, the planes in the air, everything would be flowing through space technology, military satellites. They would be used to, quote-unquote, enable the war fighter on the ground, in the air, and at sea. And so the idea then, again, of full-spectrum dominance is that space technology will allow the U.S. to completely control the planet to the benefit, and I think this is a very key point, to the benefit of corporate globalization.
Do they say that?
Well, in other words, they say it. In the planning document called Vision for 2020, they say over and over again that the profits on the Earth, that business interests on the Earth will be furthered and enabled by the Space Command's mission. So, I think it's quite clear what they're really saying. And they say that increasingly there's going to be more and more tension between the haves and the have-nots on the Earth as this corporate globalization goes forward, and that their role will be to ensure the stability, if you will, of the planet to the benefit of the business interests. So they make that.
That's obscene.
Well, it is obscene, but that is the mission now of the Space Command and of the military-industrial complex, I would say.
All right, so where can people obtain a copy of this 2020 vision, Bruce, that states those facts that you just said?
You go to our website, which is spaceforpeace.org,
yeah.
spaceforpeace.org, and you go to our link section, and we link to that vision for 2020 and other subsequent Space Command planning documents and other Pentagon planning documents that say similar kinds of things.
Well, has anyone of authority ever challenged these obscene notions that you know, we'll keep the rich for the rich and the poor can go and get themselves, you know, they don't matter, billions of people, and that corporations will dominate the world? Has anyone of any notoriety actually challenged these obscene concepts?
You have.
That's not enough.
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of people around the world that are. I'm working on our newsletter, actually, as we speak, and I've been doing reading for the last week from various industry publications like Space News and Aviation Week and Space Technology and Space Daily. And in there, I found a really good op-ed by a Chinese person writing, basically challenging this whole idea of the United States. So, for example, you know, the Chinese government, the Russian government, even the European Union has been challenging this for some time. This is why the Europeans decided to go their own way, to walk away from GPS, Global Positioning Satellites. It's largely a military satellite reconnaissance system, and targeting system that directs much of our warfare today, but also has a very small civilian application that people have in their cars and on boats and things like that. But the European Union walked away from GPS and is creating their own very expensive Galileo space reconnaissance system because they did not want to be subordinate to the United States. And at one time, when it became known that it was getting so expensive and Europe was looking around for how are we going to pay for this, they were talking to China about having China come in and be a partner in this. And at that point, the United States threatened the European Union that if you bring China into this, we'll take your system out. We'll knock it out. So it's quite clear that, yes, indeed, there are very large countries and regional formations like the European Union that are very much clear about this vision for 2020 and concerned about it and speaking out. Now, is anyone in Congress doing it besides people like Dennis Kucinich? No. Is there any famous people in America that are speaking out over and over again about it? Not many. You know, this is what we are, our work in the global network is not to rely, quote-unquote, on the famous people to do it, but to create a global constituency, to create a global consciousness about what is happening with the space program, what the direction of it is, and to build a movement around the world of citizens, of people that can slow this train down and to get a handle on it. The cost is unbelievable. And So much money is being spent on this now. And what I'm learning, again, relearning as I'm doing this research for our newsletter, that it is becoming so expensive that the U.S. can't even afford to pay for it now.
Well, let me get this straight. Global Positioning Satellite, that I use in my little Prius to find my way around Sydney and people use on their boats and etc. It's ubiquitous and useful to a degree, except we can still read maps if we wanted to and not be lazy. That is all associated with the high frontier space war. In fact, that satellite that gives us our GPS is all involved in war. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's several satellites, and most of it is classified. Most, if you think of it as a pie, most of the pieces of the pie of that satellite and what it can be used for is classified and is used for reconnaissance, surveillance, directing things like cruise missiles and drones and all the other stuff that
killing.
The Pentagon does.
Killing.
For killing, that's right. And so, but in order to sell it to the public, in order to kind of make the public feel good about this massive expenditure of money for these things. And not only do you have to build satellites, you have to then launch them, and it is incredibly expensive, increasingly, to launch things. The industry publications in the last year have been filled with nothing but cries about how expensive it's getting to launch things. So in order to sell that to the American people, to get them to fork over their tax dollars to pay for all of this, they give just a tiny, tiny little bit of that pie for these civilian GPS purposes.
So are these geosynchronous satellites, Bruce, or do they orbit the Earth?
The GPS, I believe, are geosynchronous, but many, many, there are many different kinds of military satellites that also orbit the Earth in lower Earth orbit. But one article I was just reading today was talking about how there's more than a there's more than 1,000 satellites, about 1,100 satellites orbiting the Earth today, primarily in lower Earth orbit. And it's becoming so crowded that the Pentagon is saying we've got to find a new place. And so they're talking about going way up into high orbit, but they're afraid that because of radiation, space radiation up there, that it will destroy the satellites, the very expensive, again, satellites that they put up there. So they're sending up a test satellite in the very near future to do experiments on how to kind of shield from this radiation situation, not only shield your hardware, but also your electronics on board. And so the idea then is that increasingly the new military satellites in the future, they're going to have to be put into even higher orbits, are going to become even more expensive because of additional shielding and additional technology developments and et cetera, et cetera. So
where are these military satellites launched from, Bruce Gagnon?
From several places, primarily from Cape Canaveral in Florida and Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. So those are the two primary launch places. Increasingly, though, we're seeing a literal explosion of launch sites being developed all over the world as the launch business is increasingly seen as a lucrative affair. And so not only does Russia do launching, commercial launching or military launching, China does it, of course, but they're doing it in Brazil, they're doing it here, they're doing it there. In the United States, out in Virginia, in Wallops Island, there's now a NASA launch facility that is increasingly doing more and more military launches. Kodiak Island, the beautiful, pristine salmon and Kodiak bear island, and now has a military launch facility there, sold to the people on the island as a civilian launch facility. People rose up and really fought it for several years, but were ultimately defeated. They were told, don't worry, this is just going to be about civilian satellite launches for cable TV and cell phones, things like that. But they've never launched a civilian launch yet. It's all been military.
Where's Kodiak Island? Is that on the West Coast?
In Alaska.
Yeah. Oh, it's in Alaska.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So anyway, there's a whole bunch of launch sites now to put these many satellites in orbit. Everybody wants their own satellites. Every country wants their own satellites these days, and it's crowding the orbits. And what's happening is, and because some of these things fail sometimes, sometimes they blow up, there's all this space junk up there now, this space debris orbiting the Earth at 15,000 miles an hour. And they're having to track it on these big radar screens at places like Air Force bases in Colorado Springs, where the Space Command is located. This is increasing the cost of the whole space operation. And so it's becoming an environmental disaster now. If you think of these lower Earth orbit, for example, as part of our environment that we live in, they say there's so much space junk up there now that very soon it's going to be impossible to even launch a rocket to get off the planet Earth.
Hitting something.
Yeah, that we'd be literally entombed to the planet. So, and there's no way to clean it up. So it's just all pure insanity.
How much junk is up there in the lower orbit, Bruce?
I forgot the exact number.
Isn't it about 10,000 articles larger than a centimeter or two?
Actually, I think it's more than that. I have a piece of paper stuck on the wall by my desk. I have 21,000 pieces of space debris. It depends on what size you're talking about. But I think it's even more than that now because of recent problems. The recent Chinese anti-satellite weapons test blew up and created more space debris when they blew up one of their old satellites. So it's getting worse and worse by the day. And in fact, it's getting so bad now that the Pentagon is having to rejigger their entire space weapons strategy. And that's why we're seeing this, again, this explosion of talk about cyber warfare now, because the Pentagon is really changing their whole strategy, saying that, well, you know, we can't just go up and blow up satellites. That's not going to, it's going to hurt us if we do that. We got to figure out a new way to take people out, to take out their satellites, to you know, to beat them in war. And so this whole cyber warfare, the idea of essentially crawling inside of the quote-unquote enemy's computer before you attack them, so you shut down their entire air defense system, you cripple them, they don't see you coming when you attack them, they can't really respond to you. It's a whole new kind of warfare, and so they're now scaring the pants off the American people, saying that China is way out front. China, oh my God, China is infiltrating and attacking our computers, cyber warfare. So we need a lot of money to create a new cyber command that's just been created now, and so it's unbelievable the scare tactics that are happening right now around the cyber warfare.
Well, so cyber warfare is really actually hacking. Huh?
Yeah, it's glorified hacking. That's
okay,
right.
Okay, so let's do a riff from this, Bruce. I of course have been following the fact that China has been hacking into the Pentagon systems, and these brilliant young geeks, you know, 16 who can do anything, can actually now hack into the Pentagon computer systems. And what freaks me out, I suppose, to use ordinary language, is that about 2,000 hydrogen bombs are on hair trigger alert in America, in the Dakotas and in Colorado and the like, ready to be launched by computer control. Well, yep. There are human input, but only minimal, and that can be bypassed. And the same in Russia, so that the world is laced with, you know, weapons ready to go at the press of the button, which and could possibly be launched by computers. Do you agree with that, Bruce, number one? Number two, has there been any work done on this, any scientific papers, any thought about it? That the whole system is vulnerable to hacking now because everything's computerized, including the nuclear weapons.
Absolutely. And because everything's on hair trigger alert, if someone is starting to hack into your system and you think you're being attacked, more likely that a launch happens because the timelines are now so short. I don't know of any studies, to be honest with you. It's not a field that I spent a lot of time working
but
on. But
there should be, shouldn't there?
Well, I would think so. But
can you describe to the audience what hair trigger alert means, Bruce, and the timelines involved about these?
Well, because they've created these new technologies where missiles can reach the other side of the Earth in shorter periods of time, there's less and less time with which a country can respond. In the case of Russia, I'll never forget some years ago you telling the story that after the fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of their economy, that Russia was not able to keep their computers and their satellites really updated, and that they were really lagging behind in their ability to monitor U.S. nuclear weapons. And so if the U.S. was to launch a nuclear weapon, many of their old satellites were not even able to properly detect a U.S. launch, and that they were placing their own retaliatory capability on a hair trigger alert, meaning that if they got the slightest warning from computer that something was happening, whether it was true or not, that they then might very well launch as a result, so that everything was getting shortened. All the times were getting shorter and shorter. Just in the last week, the Pentagon launched a new prompt global strike weapon called the Falcon, a successor to the shuttle, a military space plane that they say would be able to travel from one end of the Earth to the other in less than an hour, again, cutting cutting these times where you can attack someone in shorter and shorter time frames. This military space plane, the idea is it would go up like a rocket and then fly through space and then come down from space like an airplane, and then be able to drop an attack on someone and then go back up into space again and come home. The Russians and the Chinese are really worried about this technology, and so the U.S. is developing a whole series of these military space planes now. The one test that they had this past week was a failure, apparently.
They lost the plane.
They lost it. And today I saw, I don't know if you've heard this, just today I saw from Australian radio interview on their website where they have a reporter in the Marshall Islands that was saying that a U.S. ballistic missile fired from the Marshall Islands when this military space plane was falling out of the sky was that the U.S. ballistic missile went up and shot it down. I haven't been able to confirm
really?
That yet.
So it didn't really get lost.
Yeah. So anyway, that it seemed pretty authoritative. I saw a whole interview with this journalist, this Australian journalist assigned to the Marshall Islands, that was saying that it was hit by a ballistic missile the U.S. fired from Kwajalein Atoll. So, I haven't been able to find anything else on that yet. But anyway, the point is that the U.S. is developing these prompt global strike technologies that are lessening the amount of times, but is even going to make this idea of hair trigger alert even more of a problem.
Why?
Well, because Russia or China is not really sure what is coming at them.
Oh.
What's coming at me right now? What's coming at me? Does this military space plane have a nuclear device?
Oh, my God. Oh, I see.
Or does it have a conventional weapon?
Is it targeted on Moscow, and is it seen to blow up Moscow so Putin can't press his button and launch his 2,000 hydrogen bombs in America? Is that the
exactly?
Oh
exactly.
My God.
Plus, you add to that the simple fact that every year Aviation Week and Space Technology Magazine reports on the annual war game that the Pentagon, the Space Command rather, runs, called Red Team versus Blue Team.
Yeah.
Where it said in the year 2016, the U.S. launches the first strike attack on China in this computer war game. And the first weapon that is used is the military space plane, the one that was just tested this week. It flies down from orbit, drops a devastating attack on China's nuclear missiles. And so clearly Russia and China today, they see the U.S. testing these prompt global strike weapons. They see them wargaming a first strike attack on China set in the year 2016. They see them, the U.S., wanting to take out in this war game China's nuclear forces, that they have 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. And so these are the systems that are attacked in that computer war game by the U.S. So China and Russia see all this development happening. They see the United States encircling both of their countries today with so-called missile defense systems that are part of this first strike program. They see Obama making a fundamental commitment to deploy these so-called missile defense systems on ships, on Aegis destroyers, and on ground land-based launchers. And so they see Obama expanding the production of these systems, not only the ships, but the interceptor missiles. They see him creating new testing facilities, like in Hawaii, at Barking Sands on Kauai, missile test range, that they're now developing this new ground-based launch facility that they'll take these interceptor missiles that have had a pretty decent testing record off the Aegis destroyers. Now they're going to put them on a land-based launcher. They're calling it Aegis Ashore. And after they test them in Hawaii, then Obama's already announced they're going to deploy them in Romania. And they're now talking to Turkey about taking a radar, X-band radar, that would be plunked down there, and they're going to put the Patriot, a third generation of Patriot missiles, into Poland, about 35 kilometers from the Russian border.
So they're continuing the Cold War policies.
Exactly. You couple that with NATO expansion, and Russia and China both clearly see themselves being surrounded.
And they are. And where's Obama's head, Bruce? What on earth is he up to?
Well, I believe we talked about this last week, but I believe that Obama owes his time in office to the Crown family that were major stockholders in General Dynamics Corporation.
Yep.
Crown family is from Chicago. But before Obama was even known nationally, they began promoting him across the country. They're a Jewish family. They promoted him first within the national Jewish community, raised money for him, and then promoted him within the military-industrial complex. He got more money in the 2008 election from the weapons corporations than John McCain did, who's a lifetime hawk. And so I believe that Obama is now repaying General Dynamics.
He's their tool. He's their shield. Yeah.
And General Dynamics is the one that builds the primary platform for Obama's version of missile defense. Because remember, Bush had one version of missile defense, ground-based launchers. But when Obama came into office, he said, well, we're going to get rid of Bush's version of missile defense, and we're going to use this mostly sea-based version of missile defense, which are on these Aegis destroyers, which are made at Bath Iron Works, where I live in Maine, by General Dynamics.
Which is owned by the Crown family.
Right. So, you know, it's, to me, fairly obvious what's going on.
Okay, that's good. Follow the money. Now, let's talk about the other corporations involved in this huge, calamitous, wicked enterprise. Boeing?
Boeing.
Tell us about Boeing.
Boeing is one of the primary contractors for this entire program. They're building many aspects of it. Lockheed Martin is another one as well that is key, intricately involved in it. And Raytheon is another that is a key partner in all of this.
And Northrop Grumman?
Yeah, to a lesser extent. But the big boys are Boeing and Lockheed Martin.
And General Dynamics.
General Dynamics, Raytheon.
Raytheon
is building the many of the interceptors, what they call the hit-to-kill vehicles, the interceptor missiles. Lockheed Martin works on those as well. Boeing is working on many, many, many different Star Wars applications. They've recently started to get into building drones. They're also involved in a lot of the radar work. For example, the X-band radar that sits on an oil, you know, these big oil rigs, they put one of these X-band radars on top of an oil rig. It's now in Seattle, Washington, being worked on. Maintenance is being done by Boeing, although Raytheon built the radar. So, you know, they're kind of these partnerships now. Almost every one of these systems is being worked on by two or three of these corporations at the same time.
What is an X-band radar? I've never really understood it. All I know is it's a big radar that can detect missiles coming from space.
That's the bottom line. It's an early warning radar system. And in the case of this one, it's mobile because it's on this big oil platform, so it can be moved around. These radars, their primary job is to help identify missiles that are coming and then help the interceptors go up and knock them out. So they are a fundamental, they're the eyes, if you will, of the first strike system. So they talk to the satellites, all right, that see everything from up there, and these radars then help receive information from signals from missiles that are in flight, and then they help direct the entire operation.
And Bruce, we in Australia have a place called Pine Gap, which is in the center of Australia, just near Alice Springs, run totally by the US military. And I know that most satellite communications go via Pine Gap and then across the Pacific to various stations in the US. And Australia plays absolutely no role in this. And in fact, our politicians aren't even allowed to know what goes on there. And the price of the rent is one peppercorn per year. what role does Pine Gap play in this whole missile defense, Star Wars, high frontier notion that we've been discussing?
Well, Pine Gap, there are other bases like that around the world. There's Menwith Hill in England, up in Yorkshire in northern England, and there are several others around the world that are basically listening posts. Their job is to intercept all phone, fax, and email communication in their part of the world. So Pine Gap is really the Asian Pacific eyes and ears of the Pentagon, intercepting all phone, fax, email communications. At the same time, it's being upgraded for participation in this entire Star Wars program. Again, they're a ground station talking to satellites. They're receiving information. They're passing on information. And so Pine Gap is integral to the U.S. warfighting strategy in that whole Asian Pacific region. But there's also a new base built in Western Australia. There's a current base there now, a top-secret base called Harold E. Holt Naval Communications Station.
Oh, my God, really?
At Exmouth in Western Australia.
Just to say, tell you, Harold E. Holt was one of our prime ministers who went surfing one day at high seas, and he disappeared and we don't know what happened to him. So that's interesting. And he was not a very good prime minister. Pretty pathetic, really. So it's interesting that that base is named after him. Yeah. So what does that base in Exmouth do in Western Australia, Bruce Gagnon?
Well, it's a spy base, but apparently it's now being upgraded in a multi-million dollar effort to spy on foreign, quote-unquote, foreign satellites. The facility will enable Australia to, quote, become a key partner in the international battle for space supremacy, reported Space Daily recently. The base would protect the nation, Australia, from foreign exploitation by space-based capabilities, said Space Daily. My translation of that means that the base will be used to spy on China, to spy on China's satellites for the United States. And Australia, Japan, South Korea, Guam are all being linked into this very aggressive U.S. policy in the Asian Pacific to encircle and control China. The U.S. can't afford to do it by itself, so it's dragging these other places in to host bases, to host, spy facilities, and to help pay for all this in the long run. And so this is just part of that whole process.
Well, we have a very sycophantic prime minister called Julia Gillard, a woman, who is the head of the Labor Party, which is like your Democratic Party, and they just go hook, line, and sinker with anything America wants to do. Sycophantic. It makes me feel sick. We're really the 51st state of the United States, and very recently, within the last few weeks, there have been announcements that America's going to really cover the north of Australia, and I'm using that word not advisedly, but I'm being a little exaggerated, but with US bases. And the north of Australia is uninhabitable. It's desert, it's hot as hell. No one really lives there except for a city called Darwin. But they're going to put these bases around there, and obviously it's about China. And it amazes me how countries go along with this extraordinarily wicked, sinful policies of the United States. Julia Gillard admitted when she became Prime Minister she knew nothing about foreign affairs at all, and in fact she'd rather be in a schoolroom teaching children. Well, that's fair enough if she'd like to do that, but she's totally inappropriate to be Prime Minister. So she's
Could I tell you a
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
She's been taken advantage of. Yes, please.
Could I tell you a story about another Australian for a moment? One that's become quite famous, Julian Assange. In the 80s, you know that he joined the underground subculture of hacking. Mm. A few moments ago, we were talking about hacking, and so I kind of wanted to bring this story in. So in Melbourne, he got involved in the whole hacking subculture. And you might remember in 1989, NASA launched a plutonium 238 space probe called Galileo from Florida.
I sure do. I was involved.
And I organized a campaign against that. Well, just recently, my son, who was 9 years old at that time in 1989, he's now a debate coach in New Jersey, but he sent me an article that, a book that blew me away. Come to find out, one of Julian Assange's first major hackings was of NASA in October of 1989, when he attacked the NASA computer system trying to stop the launch of the Galileo plutonium rocket.
Oh, fancy that.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, and I know his mother used to take him to anti-nuclear rallies when he was a little boy.
Apparently he embedded a thing called the WANK, W-A-N-K, WANK worm, inside the NASA computer system. And I'll never forget that there were several delays before that launch, and it was never very clear as to why there were these delays. And as a result of it, I used to bring people every day to the Space Center, and all the international media was standing around with nothing to do, and we'd hold another press conference, and we got a lot of great media at that time. Well, come to find out, that was because of Julian Assange's hacking into the NASA computers. He forced about a week's worth of delays of that launch.
Do you know what WANK means?
I saw it somewhere and I can't remember now.
WANK
I don't...
in Australia means masturbation.
Oh.
Wanker is someone who masturbates.
Well, I'm sure that...
That's Australian slang for you.
Okay, well...
Oh,
I'm sure it had something to do with that. I can't find it as we speak, but...
it probably wouldn't be in any dictionary, but everyone here knows.
No, he had an acronym for it, but I don't remember what it was.
Oh, did he? Did he? Well,
yeah.
Now, okay, on that note then, Bruce Gagnon, tell us about the next plutonium satellite that's about to be launched. What's it called? How much plutonium? What sort of plutonium? What are the dangers? And what's it for?
Well, it's actually a rover, a Mars rover, that's going to be launched sometime between November 25th and mid-December.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Mars Science Laboratory, a $2.5 billion mission that is now 56% over budget. NASA just announced recently that they needed another $44 million if they're going to be able to launch it in time. And it's going to carry this rover to Mars, and on board the rover will be 10.6 pounds of plutonium-238, the most toxic substance ever created by humankind. So it's not only a very expensive mission in terms of just sheer cost, but it's also a very dangerous mission. In the event of an accident, NASA acknowledges that the plutonium could be released in some kind of a launch failure, and that it would be pulverized into dust and carried by the winds throughout Florida, and as you've said previously, literally all over the planet. The Obama administration is pushing for a redevelopment of nuclear reactors for missions to Mars. In order to get to Mars, it takes a year with a conventional rocket, and because of space radiation, it would the astronauts' bodies would literally become jello. So they want to cut in half the amount of time it takes to get to Mars. And so the Obama administration is pushing for what he's calling new technologies, and again, a code word for nuclear rockets with nuclear reactors for engines. And he's pushing also the privatization of NASA. About 80-some percent of NASA's budget now is going to private corporations.
Is it really?
And they've already had, you know, a problem, a very bad safety culture at NASA for years, as they do at the Department of Energy, where they fabricate and make these plutonium generators for these missions. And so now they're going to privatize, and there'll be even less safety regulations on these kind of these private corporations that would be pushing this stuff. So Obama is saying that we've got to really push this privatization, and that through this privatization we'll be seeing new technologies, new exciting technologies developed that will be able to get us to Mars quicker. And really what he's talking about is nuclear reactors.
And so how much plutonium-238 is on this rover that's going to go to Mars?
10.6 pounds.
And in their environmental impact statement, Bruce Gagnon, did they say how many people that could kill if, in fact, it exploded in the atmosphere, releasing the plutonium in dust form?
I'm sure they don't, but I don't have that
Well, it
memorized.
Would be millions and millions and millions, and people wouldn't drop dead. Like people in Fukushima are not dropping dead. It takes, you know, 5 to 60 years to develop your cancer. And this material, if inhaled, will almost certainly give you cancer, like less than a millionth of a gram. So we're talking about hundreds of or millions and millions of doses that will cause cancer. It is extraordinarily dangerous. How many nuclear payloads now, Bruce Gagnon, are up in space in the satellites? Do you know that?
I know there's somewhere in the low 40s. Most of them are Russian.
Yeah.
And
some have fallen out, haven't they, and burnt up in the atmosphere?
That's right. And they say all of them, because, you know, they have fuel on board that keep them in orbit. Every time they start to drop, they kick the engines and pop them back up again into the orbits again. And eventually that fuel will run out.
And, oh, my God.
And when they say when that happens, all of these will fall back to Earth.
Oh, my
burn up on reentry.
Well, how much plutonium in total is in these 40 or so Russians?
Oh, I'm sure that's classified. I've never seen any figure on that. But most of them are Russian that were put up many years ago. These are all military satellites. The U.S. has had several accidents over the years. Mm. The worst was in 1964, a U.S. military satellite called SNAP-9A. With 2 pounds of plutonium on board, it fell back to Earth, burned up on reentry, spread the plutonium globally. And Dr. John Goffman, one of the founders of uranium at Lawrence Livermore Labs, said that particular accident, he believes, he studied it quite extensively, and he believes it's one of the major contributors to the cancers epidemic that we have around the Earth today.
Yep.
You know, these things are real, and they're continually doing them and continually playing Russian roulette with all of our lives. The nuclear industry views space as a new market. You know, they want to have nuclear-powered mining colonies on the moon and Mars. They want these nuclear rockets to go to Mars. They want these nuclear rovers to drive around Mars and other planetary bodies. And so they really are excited about the possibility of massive expansion of nuclear power into space. And the Obama administration has been trying to resurrect it. Because of the cost, it's very expensive to ramp up this nuclear production process. The Congress, in a tight budget era, has not been giving Obama the money he wants to do this, but he continually asks every year for it, and he continually lobbies to get it. So talked a minute ago, they're doing another one of these missions this November.
Yes, and something reminded me as we were discussing, people say, well, you know, there's all this radioactive waste. Why don't they just load it in rockets and send it out into space? And in fact, in the 50s or 60s, they did load up 3 rockets with plutonium. and the chances of a mishap were one in millions and millions, you know. Two failed to fire, and one exploded in the atmosphere, increasing the level of plutonium by a factor of five, I think. So what needs to happen, Bruce, I think, is that this Fukushima accident has not ended, and I just heard some really alarming news today, but it only comes from one source, so I can't really say it on air at the moment. But I think it's going to get very much worse, very much faster. I wonder if over time the horror of what's happening in Fukushima will spread into the psyches and consciousnesses of the people of America, who are the ones who are going to decide about this whole nuclear future, let's be frank. And if they will rise up and say, okay, that's enough, we're going to put an end to this crazy, crazy nuclear age in space, on Earth, in the sea and elsewhere. Do you think that could be a possibility, Bruce?
I think it could be, especially if people knew about it, if they knew what was happening in Fukushima. But to be honest with you, we see very little coverage throughout this crisis at Fukushima.
Why
we've seen
do you
very
think
little
that is? Why
coverage
do you think?
In the corporate-dominated media because of the interests of the corporations that own the media today. You know, they have all these interlocking boards of directorates, and you know, the weapons corporations, the media corporations, the banking corporations, it's all the same people. It's a tiny oligarchy now that literally controls everything.
Yeah, and they all interdigitate between all the boards, don't they? I remember writing a missile envy, I think, years ago, and finding that out, and was absolutely shocked to find out that Catherine Graham, who owned the Washington Post, sat on various boards of the military-industrial complex and the like. I was absolutely amazed.
I'd like to read to you, just to get back to the whole space weaponization vision for a moment, I'd like to read to you a little bit of a quote from General William Shelton, who is the Air Force Space Command commander. He spoke last April at the 27th National Space Symposium that's held in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where the Air Force Space Command is headquartered. And he says, quote, "Our dependence on space has never been higher. In fact, it's integrated into how we fight wars today so deeply that it's hard to imagine taking space out of the equation." He goes on to say that cost overruns and schedule slips have affected virtually every new development program. Increasing launch costs are stretching the Air Force's space budget thinner still. And managing the space environment has become increasingly difficult as the most valuable orbits are now crowded with satellites and debris, and adversaries can threaten space systems from the ground or space. I say this because I want the listeners to understand that everything and everyone has an Achilles heel. And the Achilles heel of this whole vision for 2020, this full-spectrum dominance, this master of space vision of the Space Command, the primary Achilles heel of it is the cost. It is so enormously expensive that years ago, in the industry publication Space News, I read an editorial where they said, we have to come up with a funding source to pay for all of this. And and they said, we're sending our lobbyists to Washington to secure it. And they called it, their funding source, the entitlement programs, which officially in America are Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the welfare program.
Oh, my God.
So these are the programs that the military-industrial complex has identified for defunding in order to move the money over to pay for these expensive programs.
How dare they? And
so
how
if
much
you want to
they...
stop this, if you want to stop this, fight for social progress, fight for Social Security, fight for Medicare and Medicaid, and as you're fighting for them, point to these space programs, these very expensive space programs, and say, these are what we should be defunding, not social progress in America.
And do they actually say that they should get their money from these entitlement programs? Did he actually
that's
say
that? That's what they said. That's what they said.
Is that what he – did you quote that just now?
No. He didn't say this in this piece, but I'm saying some years ago in an editorial in the industry publication Space News, they editorialized, saying this is where we'll get the funding to pay for these systems.
Okay, so Bruce, how much is spent per year on this total space program, including NASA, because NASA's mostly military now, the whole thing, launching and making the satellites and making the plutonium-238 and the whole thing. And the money, of course, goes to Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and all the rest. How much per year now is the budget for this whole space catastrophe?
Well, it's virtually impossible to come up with a total figure, because you're talking about the Missile Defense Agency, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the National Security Administration, the NRO, the National Reconnaissance Organization,
yes.
NASA, the Department of Energy,
yes.
DARPA, the black budget. So by our best estimates,
yep.
I would venture to guess that it's got to be in the range of $250 to $300 billion a year. When you add up all these different things, because remember, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Coast Guard, they're all connected to satellites now. Everything they do is hooked up to space technology. All of their war fighting is run through these military satellites. So
yeah.
When you look at $1 trillion a year military budget that we have in the U.S., it has to be in the range of 300 or more, and I think that's a fairly conservative figure, 300 or more billion dollars a year.
About a third of it.
Yeah, it's got to be.
When are the American people going to wake up, for God's sake, Bruce, and say $1 trillion a year spent on death, and that's what it is, how to kill people more effectively, and see that their whole social programs and the whole of America's infrastructure is collapsing more rapidly than anyone really realizes?
Well, I think a large percentage of the American people are waking up. Just look at the figure of 70%. 70% of the American people now say we should get out of
Afghanistan. Yeah.
Now, this is in spite of the fact that you have the corporate-dominated media, that all the talk shows in America, Rush Limbaugh, all these talk shows, virtually 99% of the talk shows that are syndicated across the country are right-wing talk shows. In spite of all that total domination of the media in America, still, somehow, our message reaches the American people, 70% of them, to say that we should get out of Afghanistan and bring our war dollars home. So it indicates to me that people really do get it. But there's a breakdown. We have this corporate arterial blockage of our democracy.
I love that, the corporate arterial blockage. What is it?
It's the money. It's the corporate money involved in the our system, buying elections, buying politicians. Mm. And this is where it all breaks down. So in spite of the fact that the American people really are beginning to understand what empire is about, they really are increasingly opposed to our wars, our endless wars. Afghanistan's costing us $10 billion a month alone. People do see that the local school closed down, the fact they can't get health care, is related to this endless war spending. But the problem is, where do you go? How do you get these politicians to react? I think one of the answers is to get local politicians who are having to do the layoffs, that are having to close the schools, that are closest to the people in the neighborhoods, the local city council people, the school board people, get them to speak out against this war spending. Get them to begin to see that it is part of their job description to defend the interest of the American people, that it is part of their interest to defend social progress in our country. And not just in our country, but all the countries around the world. I think all of the local politicians should have that responsibility.
Have you been successful in convincing any of them to do that yet, Bruce?
Well, I'll tell you what. We had a rally at our state capitol a few months ago, and we had the mayor of Biddeford, Maine, a small town, less than 30,000 people, probably around 15,000, 20,000 people, textile mill town, mills have closed down, all ultimately moved overseas. This woman came and said, "I am tired of laying off teachers in Biddeford, Maine, she said. And I challenge every mayor in the state of Maine to say, bring our war dollars home. Well, that went out. Her message, her voice went out on state public radio and was heard by the people of the state. And we've now have three communities in our state that have passed resolutions to bring our war dollars home. They've now been joined by places as far away as Los Angeles, California, Eugene, Oregon, Hartford, Connecticut, Northampton, and Amherst, Massachusetts that have passed similar resolutions. And so I believe that one key organizing strategy to get us out from behind this eight ball is to get local politicians to begin to do what they don't want to do, and that is to speak out against endless war.
Okay, now I've got another suggestion. The nuclear weapons freeze began in the early 1980s, when I spoke in the capital of Vermont at Burlington, at the university, and there was a carpenter in the audience who heard me speak about nuclear war and the medical effects. And he then went on and organized all the New England town meetings throughout New England states to teach people about the medical effects of nuclear war. And that was the beginning of the nuclear weapons freeze movement. Maybe next year we can organise the town meetings and get that going again, and it should spread across the country. I think it's time people are fed up to their eyeballs with this absolutely wicked nonsense.
I recommend people go to our website that we created in Maine for this campaign. It's called Bring Our War Dollars Home.
Yeah.
It's all spelled out, bringourwardollarshome.org. And go there and check out our work in Maine. We've got a lot of information on there about our campaign. And Code Pink nationally is now picked up on this campaign and is helping to drive it across the country. And if you go to Code Pink's website, they also have Bring Our War Dollars Home.
And it's not just Afghanistan, it's everything we've been discussing today, Bruce.
Absolutely. Like it's all tied together.
One third of the military budget, $300 billion, but it's the whole thing. So, look, I want to thank you deeply once again, Bruce, for this magnificent interview. People were fascinated with the last one that you did, and now we've rounded it off. I think maybe we'll get you again in 6 months' time and keep this going, eh?
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My guest today, again, on If You Love This Planet, was Bruce Gagnon, coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. We'll be back with you again next week. Stay tuned. Things are actually happening, boiling away at Fukushima as I speak. So we will be addressing that next week and other such issues. Thanks for listening again. Go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org to check on previous programs. You can podcast this program now and let other people know so we can get the program on other community stations throughout the country. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.